Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for taking the time to download the podcast today. I'm John Montgomery. Today we'll be speaking with supervising digital colorist on Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows, Peter Doyle. But before we get into that, I just want to talk a bit about Seagraph, the FX Guide crew. Sadly, without Mr. Huser, we'll miss him. He's going to be heading to Vancouver the week of August 7th to cover Seagraph. We've got several podcasts planned for that. We've got an FX Guide TV episode, as well as articles that we'll be posting covering all the news from Vancouver. Hope to see some of you there as well. Should be a lot of fun. I talked to Mike about this a lot. I find that Seagraph is just really an awesome bit of brain food to kind of re-energize both the technical and creative spirit, as well as really to catch an insight into what we'll probably be seeing in a couple years down the road in our various software applications and so forth. Well, as I mentioned before, our podcast today is covering Harry Potter, and it's Potter Week here at FX Guide with a bunch of articles and podcasts about both the current release as well as previous offerings in the franchise. What a great franchise in total sum of the work. It's really been great, and actually I'm quite a fan of them, and we'll be missing the fact that there won't be any more, at least won't be any more related for the time being. Now, many of you may recognize Peter Doyle being a guest before on our FX podcast. It was back in September of 2009, and he got together with Mike for a talk about color in Harry Potter. You can do a search for that on the site to find it. A really technical, in-depth discussion, really fascinating. And this time, it's while certainly technical in nature, you can't avoid that. I think the approach is kind of much more from the creative and aesthetic process, and really diving down into a couple scenes that they touch on coming up in the podcast. I think you'll really enjoy it, hearing from a creative, artistic perspective, and kind of some of the technical things that form the foundation of that. So let's go ahead and join that podcast now. It's Mike Seymour speaking with Peter Doyle.
So thank you so much, Peter, for joining us again. We really appreciate it.
That's okay.
So I was wondering if I could talk to you before we got into some of the technical aspects of the film about some of the creative aspects of the film. And there's, I thought I'd touch on a couple of shots, if I could, that are pretty much not remarkable from a visual effects point of view. What I thought was remarkable about them was just how beautifully they were graded and how well they looked. And the first of those I thought we could explore is a scene in Aberforth's tavern, or the tavern in Hogsmeade. And the guys have just come in. They've effectively been saved from being busted by the Death Eaters. And it's before the final battle starts. And I was just struck in that scene that there's just the actors in a room. But especially the shots of Aberforth just seem so textural, so golden, and so sort of original, and yet sort of sensibly lit in a sense that it didn't sort of have any extraordinary lightning or anything else going on in the scene. I was just wondering, how did you kind of approach that sequence? And how did you get that look?
Yeah, okay. I guess there was two things. One is practical, and going into the film, that scene was much longer in one iteration of the cut, which meant that allowed for the scene to be a lot darker because one was in that scene for longer, so you could take in the decoration. But as the film's cut was refined, that particular scene became shorter, which meant that one needed to know where they were and to get a sense of the geography a little bit quicker. The second is just the classic practical compromises of shooting on a set as opposed to a real environment, and that's Stewart's sets are quite life-size, as in the scale of that room was in fact about the same as it would have been if it was in fact a real environment, meaning it was pretty small. Then you have a small set being shot with very wide lenses, and the time of day called for night. So you basically have a dark set with lots of black wood at night in a very small room shot on very wide lenses, which means a couple of things. That lighting, it becomes quite tricky, and with Eduardo's very naturalistic lighting. One of the impacts of that is that the ambient spill becomes quite strong. So the actual amount of shading and lighting that one would have on the walls may not necessarily be ideal, just simply because of the amount of just spill coming from, you know, the key lights and so forth. Because you can't really kind of flag off the background, because the actor would just cast shadows and so forth. So what we did was choreograph the light, and not so much relight, because it really is, you know, Eduardo's lighting, but we, in a straight-up technical sense, just separated out and modeled up the scene in our kind of jargon that we, David Yates, Eduardo, and I would have, which is basically, let's just model up the scene, which technically meant we put in a lot of windows and vignettes, and it effectively came up with two different grades, one for the actual environment and the second for the actors, which in some ways is really just correcting for color temperature. And it meant that as Aberthaw walked from the back of the set to camera and would stand underneath that light source, we accentuated that change by, in fact, having a lot of dynamic changes. So we choreographed and basically mixed from one scene of Aberthaw when he was in the corner, which was a low contrast, quite dark, and then as he walked up to underneath the light, we enhanced the lighting that was there and, in fact, faded through to a higher contrast, brighter scene. We also separated out locations by having color cues, so as people were closer to the walls, they were in fact slightly bluer, or in fact cyan rather than blue, and as they moved towards any light source, we gave it more of a yellow gold light. And that couldn't necessarily be achieved on set, just simply because the physical distance is so small that the light would just bounce around. It's just very difficult to control light to that degree in a physical location. So in summary, you could say we basically choreographed and enhanced the lighting that was there in the DI grade with lots of dissolves and wipes. So as the kids and Aberthaw sort of moved around the set, we were fading up and fading down. So a bit, I mean, you could argue you could do that with a dimmer board on set, but practically that's not necessarily that easy, because your shadows would in fact start to move. The other thing that I think perhaps gave it a somewhat unusual look, I guess, is that I was using a lot of matrixes. In that, because it was such a small set, and Eduardo wanted a very natural light, the way that the skin reacts needed light to be quite realistic and therefore not incredibly bright. So the actual light levels on set were really very low, and the neg was pushed to stop, which meant that the blacks in the blue channel changed a little differently. So to work with that, I just built a couple of matrixes that, again, technically are just incredibly similar to a green suppression kind of concept, except that it was working on the different colors. So I had a matrix built that effectively said that cyan can never be greater than the sum of the other channels in the blacks only, which is just a really fancy way, you could almost say a lazy way of grading, in that it just meant that the blacks became then extremely clean, and you didn't have the kind of ambient spill. So similar to a green screen when you have your foreground suppression a la Ultimate or Primate or any of the green screen suppressions that, right. that use a matrix that just basically does like green screen suppression. You can apply that technique to frankly any color, and it doesn't necessarily have to be just used for a green screen suppression. You could just say this set in fact has a lot of red, and it's starting to just bounce and give a kind of ambient spill under the actors. You could use a matrix to control that rather than, you know, desat the red, which then has a very different kind of look. So in that scene, what you're seeing is the results of a just a green screen suppression, because obviously where the animated painting was just a wall of green. So that obviously let some green spill just bounce around the room. And rather, and it's kind of a thing that you could say all the shots that had the painting in would have had their green screen suppressed, but a lot of feature films don't necessarily apply the same suppression to the rest of the drama shots.
Yeah.
So you're kind of fighting, it's kind of this bizarre situation that I've never quite understood why that's the case, but anyway, that's kind of other films. But on this film, obviously, if all the shots with the painting are going in, having a painting put in, and therefore having the green taken out, why would you not also take the same amount of green out of all the other shots? Otherwise, you know, they will never quite have the same feel. So you could say, just from a technical viewpoint, because there was a lot of green, the green screen shots went through compositing and had the green removed, and therefore I matched all the other shots to have the same amount of green removed, even though you might not necessarily see a green wall, you know, in the shot. But there's going to be green bouncing around, but just, and that's the way it is. So the first kind of base level is to ensure that you have the same amount of green screen suppression for the whole scene, not just the visual effects, just because by definition it's going to be there, unless the film shoot is incredibly disciplined and would do things like put, I don't know, black Bolton, or basically cover up the green whenever it's not like a visual effects shot. Now, yep. It's been years since I've ever seen that happen. And also, B, you could argue you don't want to do that necessarily, because you actually want that green to reflect the same amount through the scene as it did for the visual effects shots. Otherwise, you start to get into like a negative fill type situation. So that's kind of base level one. And that, I think, contributed to the skin tones, because you could say, okay, you park on a drama shot and the actor is looking at, say, in this case, Aberforth is looking past camera to the green screen. So you could say, by definition, he's going to be getting a fair amount of green spill on the face. Maybe not enough to say, wow, his face is green, but, you know, it's there.
Yep.
So by doing a green screen suppression on the live-action drama, rather than just desatting the green, you have a very different look. And if you just desat the green, you can really start to screw around with the skin tone and being, you know, English white actors with just very thin skin, Caucasian, you really have to be careful to start if you're starting to desat green, because the guys are just going to go very pink very fast. Whereas by using a suppression, you have a much more natural glow or a luster to the skin, rather than the life being taken out of it, which, because skin does in fact have a lot of green in it. So that's like base level one. And then base level two is the wood of the set was black, but, you know, the way film reacts and the way the set is reacting to light sources and so forth, it was coming up a kind of a dark blue. So again, by applying a matrix to that, we are able to get an absolutely perfect black, gray shading into the shadows. And by doing that, it gives the impression of contrast without it necessarily being just a black hole. Because, you know, with Stuart's sets, there's an extraordinary amount of detail that's put in, you know, and Stephanie with set decoration and set dressing just puts in extraordinary amounts of detail. You could say that Hogwarts and the sets are as much of a character as, you know, the actors in themselves. It's the place we want to be, and it's a place that people feel quite a sense of ownership. So, you know, you can't just have screaming contrast and just black holes.
I was going to say that because it seems to me that Aberforth's wearing a very dark plush kind of, I think it's a burgundy coloured coat in that scene. Of course, he's got the kind of light beard and the lighter face, but also there are sort of bookcases behind and kind of beams and stuff. And it seems to me that you've managed the toe really well, because an inexperienced colorist might kind of crush the blacks to make it look dramatic. But I'm seeing a lot of detail in his robes. I'm seeing into those bookcases, but they're not, that it's not an even overall lifted up light feeling. So you're managing that toe pretty precisely, it would seem.
Yeah, well, it's basically respecting Eduardo's lighting and I mean, if you want like a philosophical rant, you could say the color grading kind of fell off the rails a little bit or changed its concept of what it does, or that there's just been a different aesthetic with the introduction of camera negative. So, which is quite a statement, but if we think back to the old days of... let's say the heyday of commercial grading for TV, say in the mid-80s onwards, it would have been unthinkable for anybody to walk in the door with 35mm neg and put it up on a telecine chain. You know, I mean, this is way before I was ever color grading, but you know, it was always people would bring in their high-con prints and their low-con prints and, you know, go through. So there was that whole discipline there. And people were using the film prints toe to, in fact, give them the shadow the kind of tracking that was considered very desirable at the time. Then, for various reasons, the move on to camera neg happened, which gave everyone a lot of control in the mids and the highs. But at the time with, say, telecine-style panels, you know, the ranks and the spirits and all these things in the 80s, there really wasn't a lot of control for the blacks. I mean, you had your blacks, your gammas, and I think it really was only until the team from Pandora introduced, I think they called it mega gammas or some control, but it basically meant you could actually define your 1D lookup table. But that was kind of it in terms of controls for the lower part of your image. And it kind of stayed that way for quite a long time. So it's only been till, let's say, the last few years, that the very idea of adjusting blacks in any other way other than simply changing the 1D lookup table is kind of foreign. And in fact, I remember working with Andrew Lesney doing a whole bunch of tests for Lord of the Rings in the late 90s where it was pondered whether to, in fact, pre-flash the whole, you know, all the camera neg in an attempt to soften the curve. And then Also, at the time, there were things like Aricons and Vericons that pre-flashed. Basically, it reduced contrast by just yep. shining a light down the lens. So there was all those sort of things. So you could say that the discipline of grading for shadows is a discipline and an aesthetic in itself. And certainly I here in the States, you know, in the last sort of year or so, that there is in fact starting to a bit of a kickback against what people refer to as a Rec 709 grade, which is almost derogatory, but it's kind of shorthand for just really hard contrast and really steep gammas. And I see it as an almost perverse adoption of a technical mistake as an aesthetic, and that's that many directors and editors become very attached to their rushes and then very much want that rushes grade carried over to the DI, which, you know, that's a creative process and decision, which is fine. But quite often, you know, when you see rushes, what you're actually seeing is a mistransfer of something that was transferred full scale, as in 0 to 1024, and then it's actually been transferred direct into an Avid in graphic mode or whatever. So basically what you're seeing are the blacks are clipped because it's now scaled.
Yep.
But it's not necessarily seen that way because it's so down in the lower regions that it's not necessarily looking as if it's technically incorrect. It's just looking like it's got really solid blacks. And I do wonder sometimes if that's actually now been adopted as an aesthetic because this is what people have become used to.
I mean, there's a scene where Daniel Radcliffe's on a sort of a, it's not a bridge, but it's like inside Hogwarts at the end, they're fighting. And there's actually several scenes shot there, but there's one in particular. He's about to face Voldemort. They're in that sort of end sequence. And there's, you'll know this, the set, there's a lot of chains hanging, and Voldemort shoots and the gangway kind of falls away and he falls down. And I was kind of struck in that shot that you'd managed to keep a... away from the sort of bluey, it's night, this is the only way I can explain that to the audience by making it blue in the blacks. Look, you got a tonality in the grey that was almost like a charcoal. And that charcoal and the by contrast, the golden stuff of Aberforth, in both cases, I just kept on thinking these are painterly references. In one case, it was sort of Dutch European for Aberforth, and in this case, it was almost like a charcoal. I mean, is that just me? Do you have any kind of reference to, and I'm not saying literally texturally painted, but it just had these really solid palettes that weren't the obvious kind of palettes that many, let's say, more gangbustery kind of things are heading towards with sort of just, you know, bluey greens and opposite pink oranges.
Yeah, well, certainly there's been a whole debate over the last 2 years or so. In fact, Todd Phillips called it the dumbing down of color, and University of Washington even has a color design course, which is it's purple, so he must be dead. There's the whole debate about color cues, and if it's night, it must be blue. And obviously, the counter reaction to that. Certainly, going into Harry, that there was a collective agreement that we really don't want to be doing blue nights. I think Sergio Leone took it to the nth degree many years ago, doing all that day for night stuff in the spaghetti westerns. So, you know, I'd like to think that it's possible for a group of people to
move on for
a time of day with some other model other than just blue. So in terms of painterly references, there wasn't necessarily the conscious effort. I mean, you know, if you're sitting with Eduardo and you refer to Vermeer or Gould the Pearl Earring, you know, the guy's the king of it. But
Especially the Gould the Pearl Earring was gorgeous, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, you know, that's Eduardo's style, just incredibly naturalistic lighting. Stewart's sets are extremely classic. And overall, the kind of philosophy of the film was to try to make it feel like a war film, nostalgic, but not in the sense of this is a warm and happy place. But it needs to be remembered that there is, in fact, no electric light in Hogwarts.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that,
Yeah, so if you make that just as like a little manifesto, you go, okay, well, that changes, well, doesn't change things. It's just that means you have to be very careful about one's choice of color palette as well. So, for example, you know, you wouldn't have an electric blue because it just wouldn't be around. So in terms of that scene, for myself, once I walked on set and just seen, you know, what Stewart had done, it for me anyway, it just became apparent that it would be interesting to just, if you think lots of perspective and lots of arches and extremely stern, high vaulted architecture and light sources coming through window, you know, archways, so very high light sources and so forth. I mean, I personally just immediately think of Piranesi and etches and lithographs.
Yep.
So that kind of became a bit of a working idea. It wasn't as if during the creative meetings there was a general consensus to say we want to make this look like a Piranesi drawing.
Sure.
It was just, it was more like certainly we must remember there's no electric light sources, and B, we want somehow for this film to feel like a war film and not necessarily modern. But on the other hand, obviously, this is not a place that you necessarily want to be, so you're not winding in the pro mists and the Tiffin filters and everything else. So we kind of came up with the idea that to just treat it like a lithograph would be very interesting. And I think we sort of got there, I feel, and that involved a lot of work, and technically it was just about sharpening would be the buzzword, but lots of different types of sharpening. In stills photography, it's not really anything new, but certainly for motion picture imaging, it can be, just because from a technical viewpoint, there are many things you can do with a still with one frame in terms of sharpening and micro contrast and tone mapping and, you know, everything that goes under that button. I think it's called clarity within Lightroom, I think it's called. But just from an image processing viewpoint, all the techniques that come under the banner of micro contrast and tone mapping work very well and very easily with a still image, because you don't necessarily have to deal with low frequency noise or static image noise, because with a still photo you can just wind it up and the texture that you may drag out of the blacks may be technically noise, that you would see it as just a texture or a patina, and it doesn't move.
And so it doesn't buzz, okay. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't buzz like it does on the move.
Exactly. So as soon as you apply that to 24 frames of negative, you then have all the issues of the randomness of film grain, you know, just film neg. I mean, the codec stocks are really good, but, you know, the reality is that the density of any particular frame is going to be plus or minus 0.02 on any of the channels, on any grain at the time. So your clamping points and your threshold settings and so forth, are affected very adversely. So that's one needs to kind of build much more, what will basically control the take that into account. So to do that, I built the whole film, in fact, in YUV color space. So I would do a basic grade in RGB. Well, I don't want to use the word color space, but basically in, sure. in RGB, open gamut, if you will.
Yep.
Monitoring through a print lookup table, because I think this was probably the last film that would actually go to film print. But
With a lot of digital deliverables because of the 3D, you're guaranteed of a lot of digital
deliverables. Yep. It's there was terabytes of stuff. Yep.
But I'll come back to that. I'm distracting you, yes?
Yeah. So the way we got around that challenge of applying quite hardcore image processing tools to a moving image was to build the grade in RGB in a kind of open gamut color space, if you will, if that's the kind of language, and at least monitor it through a print lookup table. And then I converted the what was part of the grade, dropped into YUV, it was a kind of pseudo LAB color space, but
not really.
by absolute technical definition, it was kind of easier to drop it into a YUV, just because within the tool that we were using, it was easier to define it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, LAB within a motion picture grading system isn't exactly the most common thing around.
No.
So dropping it into YUV then allowed the application of a lot of hardcore filtering and sharpening, but to be able to control it from a perceptual viewpoint so that I could, for example, apply all the sharpening to just the luminance or the Y only, and therefore leave the color alone.
Which, of course, wouldn't amplify any color noise, would it?
Exactly. And it also meant that the definite, in which is why I'm reticent to call it a YUV, but I guess sure. it is, but the Y value was based on my definition of a weighting curve of the red, green, blue, which in simplistic terms meant that I basically dropped off the blue channel as much as I dare and weighted it to the green and the red. So, I mean, and that's kind of nothing new. That's kind of almost classic video type tools from...
Well, but also surely the Kodak stock's going to have much more sort of granularity in the blue channel. I mean, it's going to be much more noisy and
exactly.
grainy in the blue, yeah.
Exactly. So that meant that then in the color or the U and the V, I could apply I was actually quite surprised how successful it was, just enormous amounts of degraining and low pass filtering and all sorts of things that meant that you could really remove a whole lot of grain and noise and so forth, but still then overlay on top your luminance that had now been basically sharpened to all hell, and then you end up with this quite interesting patina where the color is almost bleeding, and the black and white, if you will, is like super defined, and that by separating
of course,
it out that
of course.
Way. It all meant that I could control then the amount of buzzing and graining and all sorts of things.
Because I wouldn't read any, in a sort of a lab color sense, I'm not going to read color defocus the way I'm going to read luminance defocus. So I'm going to perceive sharpness while maintaining a softness of color. Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, and again, the funny thing is it's once I looked back at the image flow path that we'd built for each shot, which then becomes, you know, basically a plug-in, for want of another word, but, you know, that's then applied to the whole scene. I think we'd basically managed to rebuild anyone who was born before last year may remember this would be, and I remember being at the ABC in Sydney when we took delivery of them, and that was an extremely old Bosch television camera using Plumicon tubes, but it ran with four because it ran with red, green, blue, and a black and white tube. And I just realized I just managed to rebuild that image processing path, which was a little scary.
Can I just throw this at you as a sort of a curveball then? Because if that's most of what we've been discussing is set shots and gorgeous kind of stuff, but it was not meant to be in high con bright sun. The other shot that just stood out for me as being wholly remarkable and not because of visual effects is when they drop off the dragon and plummet into the water. Now, those three guys going into some water should not be a really interesting shot. And you managed to turn water into a crystal sharp kind of, I mean, crystal in the sense of kind of crystal clear, sharp. It felt cold, but not because you made it blue. It's because it seemed so, icy, crystally kind of wonderful, that shot where they splash into the water. Now, I know the stuff when they get out of the water and they step up onto the embankment beside is actually studio stuff, and actually making that look like exterior is an achievement in of itself. But can you talk to me about the water? Because what did you do there to make that look so zingy and interesting?
One of the advantages of Harry is that as a film production, you know, the Warners, we really had this own complete little space bubble of a studio at Leavesden, and apart from having the full DI room at Leavesden, they in fact have the huge water tank that's like, God knows, 6 meters deep or something. So working with Tim and the underwater crew, first thing we did was actually have the guys shoot some Macbeth charts and everything underwater. The first thing was to build a kind of calibration for depth, because as you know, with water, as you move back, it completely changes color. So, in fact, when the first shots came up on rushes, my brain kind of blew up, because the idea of, you know, as something moves off into the depth, it becomes more blue, you know, like a classic landscape postcard series. But this thing was like happening within a meter. that's where coming up with some, in this case, a three-dimensional color matrix came in, because it meant if you just desat the blue, you would be desatting everything of its blue by the same amount. Because you just have a frame and the blue gets dropped out. Whereas if you're using a three-dimensional color matrix, it would just say wherever there is more blue than red and green, neutralize it to be the same. So again, somewhat like green suppression. So the first thing was to just get rid of all the color casts that were coming from the reality of having a light source above the water, and it would shine through the water and the water itself. I mean, basically, the way to think of it is your actors are actually swimming within one very large gelled filter.
In mathematical terms, you're normalizing the path, because that's what we're doing, right? We're not clipping. Yeah. We're actually normalizing through the matrix to adjust, yeah, to get those balances. But as you say, you've got this one giant gel that has to surely be somehow, not literally, but sort of visually depth dependent, because it's going to be more. Yes. I think Harry was closest to camera, if I recall correctly. I can't remember the shot. But so then Hermione and Ron were back and behind. And I presume, like most of it, it was shot on a fairly wide lens. So that would have amplified that problem, because on a wider lens, of course, that would show more distance. Did you have to do something else then? Because I can't see how that alone would do it.
Well, yeah, and then it comes into the whole sharpening, because if you think of one's own experiences in water, it's always just a little blurry, unless you've kind of put goggles on. So the idea then is then if to carry this whole theme of this kind of sharpening pack in the different spaces, you can get a very interesting texture happening, one of which is to make the water as brittle as possible. So rather than, if you just think, well, what are we actually trying to do here? And we think, well, okay, make it feel cold. And what's cold? Well, that's normally bristly ice, that kind of thing. So then you find you're actually using a language that's defining a solid rather than a liquid. So you think, well, what could one do there? And that's by definition, things that are solid tend to have sharper edges. So let's play with the sharpen. So I mean, it's quite a, you know, kind of $2 philosophical.
Well, but again, like you're saying, instead of going to a classic make it blue to make it cold, you're basically going to a sharpening of a normalized image to produce a brittleness that is more tangible and therefore reading as sharp jabbing cold rather than the, I mean, you say it's the two-cent solution, but or the philosophy, but it's actually, I think, rather a clever way of coming at the problem to communicate that to the audience without just dropping to the cliche.
Yeah, and plus also, I mean, the guy's littered. Again, it always gets back to, you know, it's always about the lighting. And the again, one of the advantages of being at Leavesden is the guys could shoot the stuff on the water tank. I could come down and we could go, well, that might work. You know, run some neg, play with a little grade, and then the guys could see how it's kind of reacting and then adjust the lighting appropriately. So I think in that case they lowered the lights physically and diffused them a little more just to give it an even kind of even softer look to avoid the kind of, you know, Caribbean holiday, you know, light shafts dappling, which is, you know, absolutely the antithesis of where everyone wanted to be.
Yeah.
And also carrying through, you know, Eduardo's theme of this very naturalistic light. And they, I'm just remembering, yes, there was bounce. They put bounce on the bottom of the water tank, just to give, you know, some bounce light, basically, from underneath.
Can I ask you a technical question? I know when we spoke in 2009 on Half-Blood Prince, that, and obviously Eduardo wasn't the DOP on that, but you said that everything was shot about a stop down to basically produce some built-in protection latitude. Was this stuff also pretty much a stop down?
Although in terms of language, yeah, I mean, it's basically the both Eduardo and Bruno sort of rated their 500 stocks at 320.
Right.
So that just meant that and exposed for about a 4-to-5 stock contrast ratio. Eduardo certainly ran with a slightly higher contrast than Bruno, which is just the style at the time for the film. But by just rating the neg at like 320, it just meant that you're shooting at the on the more linear part of the neg. And that what you're saying is black, and what you actually feel that you want to see is still in the linear part rather than it falling into the toe of the neg, which then can get a little wacky to try and work with.
Yeah, and by definition isn't linear.
Yep.
So let me ask you this. Also, when we were talking at that time, you said that while you were shooting on wides in that film, you did a kind of, I'm going to call it roto, but it wasn't like a, you know, hair-accurate roto, so that you could add a bit of defocus. So even though you were on the sort of slightly wider lens, you could actually have some subtle depth of field stuff that maybe wasn't there in the neg, and that was part of the grading process. I was, I guess, maybe caught up in the film, and I didn't notice it as much in this film. Or was it there as much as you'd done in Half Blood Prince?
There was certainly very little of playing with the depth of focus on 7. Most of the film was shot around 2.8 to even down to 1.4.
Oh, really?
For a couple of scenes.
Well, that would have had quite a shallow depth of field on its own then.
And also the idea is that it was a war film, so we didn't necessarily want it to feel too pretty.
Right. So now I was talking to somebody at one of the effects houses, and they complimented your team and your process for really getting in front of the visual effects, I think were the words they used. And we touched on color managed visual effects before. Could you talk to us about what you or the team did pre-feeding these things through to VFX so that you had, because this is a very well-established pipeline, but also incredibly tightly managed because you were on, obviously, from the beginning of the film and oversaw the whole lot.
Yep. The pipeline would be that we would, or I'd build the grade with our DP, present to a director, and have the rush's grade approved. That would then be a basic template for where the shot's going to go. And it's kind of as basic as it's day or it's night, or you know, it's cold or it's warm. Then our visual effects colorist Mel Kanglian would pull those rushes grade apart, which were HD, and build just a printer light style grade. Using the scans, which for these films came from CineSight. The scans were sent simultaneously to whatever vendor at the time and our DI department. So that meant that all the vendors around the world would get all their scans. And at the same time, Mel Kangley and the VFX colorist would get the same or a copy of those scans. And would set two grades. One we called the neutral grade, and the second, for want of a better language, we'd call the primary grade. Now, the neutral grade were and still is a code value offset that any vendor could go to a website, get those numbers, plug them in into their shake or nuke or flame or whatever, and that would mean that scan would now be color graded the way we feel that it should be. And that meant, therefore, that if, I don't know, for example, Rising Sun was working on a complete sequence, they would have all the shots for that sequence graded by one person, Mel. And that grade would then be also then based on where the DP and, you know, where we'd set it for the rushes. There'd be a second number, which was just printer lights for one of another language, and that showed how much we were printing the shot up or down. So typically, we went into it printing the whole film down a stop. So from a big picture viewpoint, it meant that all the vendors and all the compositors were building all their shots and their composites, typically a stop brighter, knowing that it would then be printed down a stop when it goes into the grade. Now, all this would happen just with red, green, blue offsets, so no DSATs or fancy stuff like that, because it meant that when the shots came back, they were effectively the same as the original camera neg, but just with their work added. So it's in some ways, it's very much like the digital equivalent of the old days, where, let's say, in the old days, you would get your film print as your match grade or your match clip, and you would build your visual effects and add all your stuff on top and then deliver the visual effects back the same color you got it. The difference with this model is that the visual effects shots would come back with this neutral grade baked in, which means it's a color that we know that it should be because that's what we've sent, which means I could then grab Mel's grade and then start working on the DI side of things, all the DSATs, the filters, the sharpening, and basically the look, if you will, on the raw plate that the visual effects people are using with the same number. So then as the visual effects shot comes in, I can just swap it out and copy the grade, and it will be the same grade. So that meant that then Tim Burke, our visual effects supervisor, would be able to see the visual effects in context with the current work in progress grade to see if anything was broken or not. And it also meant that the vendors would be able to sit down, get a sequence, load up the numbers, and have all the plates timed within each other and sort of not actually have to worry about that. Yes, it also meant that if their monitoring was slightly different to ours because, you know, the lead compositor managed to grab the window seat, you know, it doesn't matter kind of thing, because it's all relative. Because then they're doing all their magic relative to that shot. So if their monitoring is slightly green or slightly blue, that really doesn't matter, because they're kind of building all their work within the context of the shot within itself. And then with his second light, they would just keep that print down in their monitoring, which meant that if we then decide that the whole sequence is running too dark or too bright, or that, you know, overall it's feeling that you know, it's actually going to be a little warmer, we could reissue that monitoring grade, so that the guys could see that, okay, the whole shot or the whole sequence is in fact running a little darker, so we can just keep an eye on the shadows and see what's happening there, or vice versa. Because one of the kind of trends that I've seen with all this work being done now in EXR and with HDR scans and all the monitoring and so forth is that sometimes it seems to come as a surprise to the visual effects houses of what's happening in their blacks and their whites, because they're not necessarily seeing their work with the correct curve, particularly in the highlights. So by doing this way, they can actually print it up and down and see that, wow, they are actually running this much darker, so we need to pay attention to all our sky plates, for example, or something like that. Now, that model seems very convoluted, but it's actually...
No, it doesn't, because it also, it seems to work well under the fact that you would then have to, because there's one more stage after this, that you have to allow for a large proportion of your audience wearing polarizing filters on each of their two eyes. And so that grade is going to have to be universally adjusted compared to the 2D grade.
Yes. And in fact, we had a last-minute call. In fact, we had just delivered a 3D final version of the film when Michael Bay had announced that he'd struck a deal with Real-D and that there'd be 6,000 screens in the US running Transformers at 6-foot Lamberts in 3D rather than the kind of de facto industry, I don't even want to use the word standard, but acceptance that 3.5-foot Lamberts is kind of where things are sitting at the moment for 3D. So we had to fire up a 3D room and just check that all the grade in 3D would actually work. In fact, brighter rather than darker, which was sort of a thing unto itself, but that all seemed to work.
Which is the famous secret sauce sort of marketing thing that Transformers came out with at the last kind of stage. What did you do? What was your solution? I mean, did you just...
Exactly the same. I mean, right. The thing is, you know, to run a 3D grade where you need more color, more sharpened, slightly higher contrast and a brighter light source, that is not a big secret.
Yes.
So for Harry, we effectively we ran with three grades. So I built a master grade, if you will, in 2D in this sort of what I call this open gamut color space, and I monitored in 2D with a print emulation lookup table. And to get absolutely specific, the twist on that is that my print emulation lookup table is in fact one stop darker than what I in fact would record out.
Okay.
So that meant that I ended up with a complete master grade and master render of this film that in fact was one stop brighter. So, you know, technically my blacks were sitting at the code value sort of 180 or something. So it meant that I had just about everything's still in some kind of value rather than the blacks being absolutely clipped out. Then I opened up the 3D grade with our 3D colorist, Greg, who was doing all the convergence paths and all the other bits and pieces for 3D. Don the glasses, don the switch off the barcodes and switch on the Dolbies and all that world, and then build a take this master render, if you will, and sit it within a world that seems to work for 3D. And that involved, curiously, even more sharpening because technically 3D, you know, it's just, you know, we do all this work running in full 10-bit RGB, and we monitor everything in HD, SDI, dual link, blah, blah, blah. But you switch on 3D, you're now back to single link, and you're now down to 422 color. So it's just, well, you just have all the impact of dropping from, you know, HD, SDI, 4x4 monitoring down to single link 422 YUV monitoring. So, you know, the image gets pretty soft. Your color just loses its definition. And obviously because it's darker, the blacks kind of get wacky and so forth. So,
which begs the question, Peter, if you had an old friend over for dinner to your place in Europe and he asked you or she asked you, hey, I'm going to go and see your Harry Potter film, would you recommend I see it in 3D or 2D? Speaking only for yourself, only personally, what would your answer be?
Personally? Oh, I would ask to see one of the show prints that we made.
And I have a question for you just in terms of what's developing now in the industry in terms of scene linear workflow and Acer's color space and stuff. And I was wondering, obviously digital cameras are increasingly able to produce a higher dynamic range, and that can be translated to a certain extent into a scene linear workflow that goes straight into an OpenEXR. And I'm wondering whether the Acer's initiative and stuff is something that you've had a chance to look at and offer an opinion on, and if so, would you share it with us?
Yeah, I had a look at it quite a while ago. I think it's all good. Just conceptually, there's kind of an interesting challenge, and that certainly with the digital cameras, you are getting a theoretical increase in your dynamic range. However, that is very open to discussion or an interpretation, because at some point you have to say, okay, you know, you can say clearly if an image is clipping or not. But, you know, with a film neg, it unfortunately, well, it's the way it is, it is actually open to an interpretation whether an image is in fact overexposing or not. And likewise with clipping, say with a digital camera, just as with a histogram, you know, you can look at a histogram and go, okay, this image looks fine, but, you know, is that sampling every 16th pixel? Is it every pixel? So therefore, you have this kind of interesting discussion, or you need to qualify, okay, this image is not clipping based on what? And you would say, well, because of the lookup table or the histogram or whatever, but you would probably find that there are some pixels somewhere probably clipping. So, okay. So the DPs, you know, if they're beauty shots or whatever, will give themselves plenty of headroom so that all the highlights are captured, which is great. And, that, you know, that can work really well for digital. But the downside is that you... Because the guys are having to give themselves the headroom to capture all the highlight detail so that there is no clipping at all, whereas on the neg, you would just have this very soft roll-off happening in the whites anyway. I'm just noticing that the digital images, therefore, are being pushed down into the blacks to make room for the highlights. And because it's completely linear, or the, you know, the chips are linear, you've now got enormous amounts of your information way down in the blacks, more than you would have with the neg. And you
but,
know,
how valid is that, do you think? I mean, because I would certainly argue that it doesn't really matter if a pinging highlight off a car is going into the clip because it's a pinging highlight, and yet obviously it's maybe not rolling off into the whites quite as nicely as film, but trying to maintain pinging highlights from clipping at all is, I would have thought, just going a bit too far the other way. Or what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, correct. And certainly with the new dynamic range stocks, you know, there is actually plenty of clipping inherently from the neg, you know, in like fire shots where we basically scan for shadows rather than scan for highlights. There's just something about the shaping of that clipping that I'm just finding that there's more, the image is intrinsically darker, so that it means that you're actually further down towards the blacks than you would be with an egg. So in simple terms, the shots are coming in more underexposed than neg. So then you're working, you're getting closer to the noise, or the chip noise, and you're dealing with a debyed image. So you just don't have that much to play with. So certainly what you've gained in a perceived increase in dynamic range, you've actually given up in noise and, in fact, color.
But I mean, in the old film school rule of thumb, we used to say that in film you're better off overexposing a fraction because you need to get something in on the neg and it's got to kind of burn its way into that piece of celluloid. And in digital, you're better off sort of underexposing a bit because you want to kind of go the other way and make sure that because you've got so much more latitude in the blacks, that's where you want to be sitting. And also the black floors seem to be so much better these days. And even if they aren't perfect, the black floor is still, if you like, in place of the film grain structure. So, I mean, it's not as if film doesn't have noise. It has film grain, but it doesn't have digital noise, obviously. And so, again, it's almost like, isn't avoiding any noise in the blacks kind of like trying to have a grainless stock? It may not be necessarily, you know, don't sort of wish too hard for it because it may not be what you want. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's, I just find that it's just very tricky to grade with. I personally have only actually delivered one film that was shot digitally. You know, that was I just really wanted to see what it'd be like to work with digital imagery. And, we shook hands with the DP Henry that, you know, I could grade it if we were allowed to rate the camera, which in this case was a Genesis. So, you know, we all agreed and we did all our tests and everything else and took a long, hard look at clipping versus noise and just came up with this number of 680. The thing is now kind of got a very interesting situation. For example, the red cameras look pretty good at 800, but if you're shooting digital, it tends to be with 3D. So, again, these are just gross generalizations. So sure. Even though you may have 800 now on the camera, by the time you get all this crap in front of the lens, you've just lost two stops. So now you're having to push it and, you know, run the camera at like 1600. So now I had a dinner a couple of weeks ago with three DPs, which was a bit scary in itself, frankly, but two were shooting with Red Epics and one stood with hands on shoulders going, on hips while I'm still on neg. And it was just interesting, you know, hearing and sharing that there are various issues. Certainly, I don't think digital is the savior of everything. There are certainly issues with it, and there's also many good things with it as well. I just have found, interestingly, that, you know, because I just finished doing some tests for a project, you just can't throw the image around anywhere near as much as you can with a well-exposed 35mm neg. Mm. That, you know, that's just... so it is very much like shooting on reversal or kind of going halfway back to that world where...
Well, especially, I mentioned, did you need 200T on this? Because, I mean, the 200 stuff really takes a beating, doesn't it? Did you...
Yeah.
It was mainly 500 you were shooting on this, though, wasn't it?
No, they actually broke out some 100 on the Heaven sequence, which is actually amazing, because I hadn't worked with that stuff for a few years, and it was quite a shock to just see how unbelievably sharp and grainless film can be. But, you know, there's other issues with that.
So which stock was that? There was
the 100.
Really? So not the 5217. What's that? The 5217? God, I haven't seen anyone use that for ages.
Yeah, it was... people stood around and stared at it. It ended up that the poor sound crew had to wear sunglasses. That's how bright it was on set.
Wow. I noticed... Oh, God, maybe it's just me being a jerk, but I noticed at the bottom of his robes in that white sequence on King's Cross Station seemed to see slightly different tonality. Was there... Did that just drop off in light because they had lights close in on him, or were you sort of doing something? It just seemed to be... I don't know if it was conscious or not, but I just felt like there was sort of a conscious gradation. It wasn't like it was just flat across him.
No, that's it was intentional. Yeah.
By the way, I didn't ask you, and I should have. Are you still grading on a film like Baselite? Kind of, what's your sort of weapon of choice?
Today I just it's still. Still a film light, Baselite, yep.
And your crew, I remember being astonished on the last time we spoke in 2009, was relatively small it was microscopically small, actually, not for budgetary reasons, just because you seem to have a very tight crew. What was your team that you were supervising for putting together this seventh part, 1 and 2?
Yeah, we had Mel Kanglian, who's a second colorist. Mel handled all the visual effects, grading, reviews, and just everything to do with all the visual effects shots and grades, and then picking up sequences for me. And then we had Grace Lorne, who is kind of operations supervisor / data kind of world. And then Nicholas Aldergreen, our software guy, basically writes all our custom code. And then for 3D, we brought on an additional colorist, Greg Fisher, who basically handled, sort of the 3D pass, if you will. And we just use a lot of scripts.
So, look, I'm going to ask you one last question, which I normally wouldn't ask because it seems like a really ill-informed, stupid, unprepared question, but I actually would genuinely like to know, is there anything in this last film that you're particularly proud of? Is there any particular scene that you really enjoyed the grade of? Because I'd just genuinely love to know.
I think the whole courtyard battle is a combination of, I think it looks pretty good, and it's also a sense of relief because that sequence was shot across many months with many cameras, with and without actors, in fact, on the same set on the same day. And we're talking in English, summer through to winter. So as the stuff was coming in over the months, I was really pondering, this is probably going to be the end of my career. it kind of, team with visual effects did a sterling job, basically doing all the set extensions and making that whole side of things work. And the grade, I think, was interesting in that, it's a big dramatic moment. Neville has his big moment and Voldemort's got his big moment. So it was a lot of monologues in the film. So, that's the last thing you want to do is kind of kill the performance by making everyone very aware of the actual medium. So I think the grade seemed appropriate, and interestingly, it seemed to, in fact, carry across to the 3D as well, because it would appear, at least based on reviews, that people didn't really, at the most basic level, have an issue seeing anything.
no, far from it.
Think it seemed reasonably consistent. and you could buy into it. Like, you know, the grade, I don't think, screamed, this is $1 million visual effects, or going the other way on doing the whole screaming contrast and, you know, lots of grain and all of that, which was certainly, you know, the first initial reaction to it. You go, okay, well, it's a war thing, so why don't we do a Saving Private Ryan kind of thing? But it's just completely inappropriate. So I think that sequence was pretty happy with.
Well, look, I can't thank you enough for taking time out from your schedule to talk to us again. We really do appreciate it. And it's just been a fascinating talk. Honestly, I wish we could talk for several hours, but I don't want to consume any more of your time. But thank you so much. We do appreciate it, so thanks.
Yeah, no problems. Thank you.
As always with our guests on the FX podcast, it's really so great that they share in such open detail information about the craft, their thoughts behind it. I really appreciate and respect the openness that the people who do these podcasts do. And of course, Peter Doyle is no exception. I think it was an incredibly fascinating discussion, even for someone like me, who's not a professional colorist. I found it quite fascinating. Well, that's it. As I mentioned again before the podcast, we'll be up in Vancouver for Seagraph, Ian, Mike, and myself. Missing Jeff. But as always, for those guys and all of us here at FX Guide, thanks for taking the time to listen. See ya.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by Seagraph Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of Seagraph Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to seagraph.org/Asia2011.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.